Welcome to Season 2 of The Wayfarer's Guide to World Building, a podcast for writers by Mythos and Inc. Publishing. I'm Kyle.
I'm Emma.
I'm Allison.
And I'm Christiana.
Our theme for Season 2 is sci-fi and fantasy tropes. Writers often think of tropes negatively, but they're just commonly used themes or plot elements, symbols of the genre that keep readers coming back for more. Understanding tropes and using them effectively can deepen your world building. But before we go on, I think we should maybe say welcome to new listeners. It's the first episode of Season 2. Yay!
Welcome!
Yay! good news, if you are a new listener, there's an entire season for you to listen to, but you don't need it in order to listen to this episode. It's not serialized in that way, but it's still beneficial. For all you returning listeners, there's change.
No, not change.
Because writers love change. But we do have some changes coming for Season 2.
One of the changes for Season 2 is that our entire season has a theme. And Yay. The theme is sci-fi and fantasy tropes.
Not Yay. Troops, as I originally read it.
Not troops. Tropes. Those tropes. Common themes that we find in our favorite stories.
Not orc armies. Got it.
You got it.
Another cool change that we've got is we actually have 4 hosts now. So if you listened to our Shadow and Bone series last season, you will have already met Christiana, who is our fantastic 4th host. They will be rotating in and out with us. So every week you will hear 3 of the 4 hosts and you get to experience more Mythos and Ink staff. Isn't that awesome?
Ooh, and we're having more bonus episodes on Patreon this year, but we'll have more on our Patreon revamping stuff a little later. Today's trope, the legendary artifact of power. Special thanks to our patron Jack for making this episode possible. If you are a patron, send us your writing, world building, or publishing questions for us to answer in our bonus Q&A episodes, which we record as a thank you to our patron supporters. If you want to become one of our patrons, we have revamped it, hint, hint, for Season 2. Head to patreon.com/mythosandink. By the way, again, new folk, I'm Kyle Rudge, he, him, the business and marketing director of Mythos and Ink, and today, I am your host.
I'm Allison Alexander, she, her, and I'm the executive editor at Mythos and Ink.
And I'm Emma Scrimita, she, her, editorial assistant at Mythos and Ink.
The thing that separates a legendary artifact of power from other magical items is rarity. There's often only one. And the artifact is so powerful, it may have the ability to end worlds, or at least cause a whole lot of destruction. The power usually makes the object one of great desire, or even myth. Who's up first in our first Season 2 episode?
It's me.
Oh, no. Is it going to be Lord of the Rings?
Of course it is.
Oh. Yes, I am starting Season 2 as I ended Season 1, which is entirely on brand, talking about Lord of the Rings. And if you didn't want me to, you shouldn't have chosen Artifact of Power as our first topic.
My bad.
How could we talk about legendary artifacts of power without talking about the One Ring, the quintessential legendary artifact of power?
It's true.
Yeah, that's fair.
The One Ring is, of course, the most powerful item in Middle-earth. I mean, this is probably up for debate, but I am declaring it to be the most powerful item in Middle-earth, and it is the source of all power of the evil Lord Sauron. Of course, the plot of Lord of the Rings trilogy revolves around the necessity of the ring being destroyed, for that is the only way that Sauron can be undone. The power of the ring is not fully explained. A lot of Tolkien's magic systems are very soft, so that is, a plug for our previous season, go listen to hard versus soft magic systems to find out what that means. But essentially, it means that he doesn't go into a lot of detail about how magic works or necessarily even what could be done with magic. This is very much the case for the One Ring, as we don't know a whole lot about what it can actually do, aside from the fact that it's very powerful. It can turn you invisible, and if you have it around you, it will start to corrupt you. We see this happening a little bit with Bilbo. We see this happening with Frodo. We see this happening a huge amount with Sméagol/Gollum. The ring will turn you evil if you have it around you long enough. Why is this good world building? Well, I like it, A, because it uses the "this really powerful thing was under our noses the whole time" trope, which I love. Because, of course, at the beginning of The Lord of the Rings and in The Hobbit, when the ring is first discovered by Bilbo the Hobbit, he has absolutely no idea the magnitude of what he has discovered. He knows this ring is more than an ordinary ring because it can turn him invisible. It's magic, obviously, but he has no idea that it is that powerful. Even Gandalf doesn't really know what Bilbo has discovered until the events of the Fellowship of the Ring have kind of kicked into gear already. I love it when the characters find out that they've had this hugely powerful thing with them the whole time. So that's one reason why I love this example. And I also like it because it turns the previously classic artifact quest on its head. So in mythology, where legendary artifacts feature prominently, like, you know, the Golden Fleece or the Holy Grail, the point is always to retrieve that item and claim its power for yourself, whereas the One Ring is a bit of a reversal of that because they actually have to destroy it and get rid of the power. So I thought that's a creative use as well.
One thing that I really love about the One Ring is that it's addictive. Do you think that adds anything to the world building?
I think it does in the story that Tolkien was trying to tell, because it is addicting, but not necessarily in the exact way that a substance is addicting, and not even addicting in the way that, for example, in Buffy the Vampire Slayer, magic is addictive to Willow, but it's more addicting in the way that power is addicting. It's this power is corrupting, and it's very much an analogy for that. And I think that's a great usage and really does play into a lot of the themes of the wider story, which is really the best way to use world building, in my opinion.
Now, there may not be an answer or a right answer for my question. It may just
there's evoke. A right answer to everything, Kyle.
That's fair. and I think I can ask it without a whole lot of context because enough people understand the story of Lord of the Rings. My question has always been, why was it important for Frodo to carry the ring and not Samwise, who seems to be, at least from my perspective, more pure of heart?
I mean, I might counter that with perhaps one of the reasons why he is more pure of heart is because he wasn't carrying the ring. Of course, we don't know this because he does carry it for a bit, but he's never he never has it for as long. So we may have seen a more corruptive force on Sam had he been carrying it for longer. But I also think that it was important because it allowed us to see two different types of strength, one which is doing the hard thing, which is what Frodo is doing, and then one which is also supporting somebody while they do the hard thing. So I think it's really beautiful that we get to see both sides of that, which we wouldn't necessarily have seen if it was Sam carrying it or if, you know, it was only one of them by themselves.
Right.
Can I also answer this question?
No, Allie, only me. Yes.
Well, she got it right, though, Allie.
Oh, no, I totally agree with her. I'm just remembering that Sam does put on the ring, and he gets corrupted pretty quick by it, actually. Like, he's suddenly sees visions of himself as this hero, and he really doesn't like wearing it. And Frodo seems to be just way more naturally resistant to the ring than anyone else. I think that's the case. Is that the case, Emma?
In the books, Faramir is actually shown to be pretty resistant to it as well. Oh, like, he's one of the few people who, and this was a pretty significant change from the movies to the books, but in the books, he doesn't even want, like, he wants nothing to do with the ring. He says he wouldn't pick it up, whereas, of course, in the movies, he's shown to be as very corruptible.
Yeah.
Which I actually don't mind that change. Like, that might be controversial, but I think that was a pretty good decision on the part of the filmmakers. But you are right that, like, Frodo is definitely one of the ones who seems the least significantly corrupted by the ring, given how long even he's carrying it for.
Man, I feel like we could just talk an entire episode about
we totally
this
could.
Podcast is now Emma, Lord Kyle, Rings. And Allie talk about Lord of the Rings.
Well, I love a good quest story, which is why I'm going to talk about the more traditional quest, and that is Del Toro Quest by Emily Rada, which is really funny because Emma talked about maybe talking about this in this episode. And I was like, no, that's my topic. Mine.
I just steal Ali's idea, but.
Yeah. So in the land of Del Toro's history, each of seven tribes possessed a magical gem with unique properties. A blacksmith named Aiden made a belt that brought all the gems together and united the tribes against their enemy, the Shadow Lord. This is a middle grade series, FYI. This is for kids. I read this as a kid. Only when worn by an heir of Aiden does the belt have the power to drive the Shadow Lord from the land. But the Shadow Lord was cunning and patient, and generations later, he stole the belt and scattered the gems throughout the land. This is where the story begins, when the land is ruled and oppressed by the Shadow Lord, and a boy named Leaf is tasked with collecting all of the gems and uniting Del Toro's tribes once more. I love this story so much. I read it over and over again. It's just really fun, traditional quest. It's so good. So every book in the series is collecting one gem. It also just appeals to my, like, progressive perfectionist, I don't know, things in order, my, every, you know.
Every side quest must be checked.
Yeah. So this is good world building because, for one, the magical item isn't just a prop, but it is used to progress the plot of the story. And for another, though the belt is incredibly powerful, it also has limitations. For example, it won't work unless it's put together and unless Aiden's heir is the one wearing it. And there's one other limitation, but that's a major spoiler. So just in case you want to read it, and it's wonderful and you should, or read it with your kids, I won't spoil.
They're so short too. You could breeze through those in like an afternoon. Really, you can definitely short. Read them. They're so good. Yeah. So I've got a question, which I actually isn't a genuine question because it's been a while since I read these books. I don't remember. But do each of the gems have a power on their own, or is it like zero until they're all connected and then it's powerful?
They actually all have a power on their own, which is, it's kind of random stuff. Like the emerald is a remedy for sores and ulcers and an antidote to poison. And so like, whenever they collect one of the gems, they kind of get this boost to their ability, which they often so happen coincidentally to need in the next book. You know, just happens to save their lives or something.
Very linear, you know? Video game style.
Yeah. This would make a great video game. Is there a Del Toro quest video game?
There's an anime, like an animated show. I know. Oh. I watch. It's sad.
Oh, okay. I have to watch that now. Man.
I tried watching it. I couldn't get past the first episode.
You spoke that in each of these seven tribes possessed a magical gem with unique craziness. One thing, I'm glad I didn't talk about the Infinity Gauntlet today, because this feels like feels exactly like an Infinity Gauntlet story. But where did these gems come from? Is there like a mythical origin? And ultimately, why doesn't the bad guy just destroy them? Like, done.
Those are all good questions. I don't know if I have the answer.
What? Because it's a middle
case. I don't know if it goes into detail about where the gems came from, but each of the tribes had one. And it's kind of just a nice parallel that in the history, Aiden had to unite all these tribes who didn't really want to unite. Like, so he slowly, I'm assuming, collected each gem and brought them together. And then that you kind of see that happen again in these seven books, which I really like.
Were these tribes?
Sorry. Oh,
no, go ahead.
Why didn't the Shadow Lord destroy the gems? I assume they can't be destroyed. It's been a while since I've read the series, but I'm pretty sure he would have if he could have.
The gems each had their own unique properties. Were those properties reflected in the tribes themselves? Like,
yeah.
And how they dressed, or their culture, or their food? Were there reflections of that?
Each gem represents a, what's the word for like courage, strength?
Virtue.
Okay.
So like the diamond is courage and strength and, trying to remember here. The lapis lazuli, am I saying that right?
I don't know
if I'm saying that right.
I've only ever read the word.
lapis lazuli symbolizes fortune and good luck. And so each of those things somehow connects to the people that it belonged to, which is also a cool little detail.
I like it. I like it. Mm-hmm. I like when culture impacts the artifacts.
Yeah,
power.
Me too.
Well, my example comes from a very old folktale. It's been told, retold, transformed, and mashed into many stories along the way. So I'll kind of pick a point in time for this artifact of power, because there are elements of it that go back as early as the 1700s. So I've got a lot to choose from. It's from the Book of 1001 Nights, or Arabian Nights, and the artifact of power is Aladdin's lamp. And I have to choose the Disney version with Robin Williams as the genie.
Of course.
You can't not.
It's probably the most well-known version in our culture, at least.
I think so. I think that's enough for us to pull on. And there's some really good examples of world building. So in the Disney version of Aladdin, there's this lamp that's hidden in the forbidden cave of wonders where only one who is worthy, good old chosen one, a diamond in the rough may enter to retrieve this artifact of power. It's kind of got that Excalibur-esque feel to it. Once retrieved, a quick polish of the lamp reveals a powerful genie who will grant the owner of the lamp three wishes. These wishes, of course, have limitations.
You're gonna grant me any three wishes I want, right?
Almost. There are a few provisos, a couple of quid pro quos.
Like?
Rule number one, I can't kill anybody.
Yeah, so don't ask.
Rule number two, I can't make anybody fall in love with anybody else.
You little punim there.
Rule number three!
I can't bring people back from the dead. It's not a pretty picture. I don't like doing it!
Other than that, you got it.
Like most stories involving artifacts of power, it becomes the thing to protect and or acquire depending on the side you're on, I guess. Aside from the music and me not subjecting everyone to singing of a whole new world, despite me desperately wanting to.
Could we get a Patreon goal if we hit 1,000 patrons? Kyle will sing a whole new world.
I'll do a Disney karaoke as an episode and the three of us will do it.
If we don't reach a certain number, we will punish you.
we'll tease one of our flash fiction stories, but really it'll just be me singing karaoke terribly. Anyways, this is good world building because these limits placed on limitless power adds to the tension of the story. So Aladdin doesn't have infinite time and infinite wishes to get it exactly right. Every single wish must matter. Other rules like death, life, and love only add to the beauty of the story because they demonstrate that there are forces beyond limitless power. Death is final and love conquers all. The limitations become the moral of the story. The culmination, of course, comes where Aladdin gives up the incredible force because he's realized what's important, those that he loves, and the genie is freed. So yeah. I love Aladdin.
My question is, how does this artifact add more problems to the story than solutions?
Well, so I mean, I don't know. Should I talk about, I'll talk about the Disney version because there's different answers to that question throughout the different types of stories. But in the Disney version, the genie doesn't always get things right. It's not out of a sense of malice or anything like that. It is just, I thought you meant this and this is what I did and it all went wrong. And so usually in a lot of the, at least in the TV show that I also loved as a child, by the way, so good. What would end up happening is, okay, genie tries to solve it with a Deus Ex Machina style of answer, but then realize, wait, we had the answer in front of us all along and we didn't need the power. We just needed to go back on our principles and values. And so usually that's where it ends up playing is like the wishes that the genie makes are not really important and often cause more obstacles than they actually overcame, I guess would be the word.
So you've piqued my interest. You keep talking about all of these different versions. So do you know anything about what some of the differences are between the Disney version and some of those older original versions of the story?
Yeah. So in preparation for the episode, I was like, I should probably read Arabian Nights.
So, good call.
So I went back and I read because I wanted to see what was different. And there is so much that was different. So like the history of it was that it wasn't in, because Arabian Nights is like 7th century, 8th century. But the translated from Arabic version comes around 1700s. The Aladdin story was never in the original. It only became when it was translated by a Frenchman who claims that he heard it from a Syrian man, et cetera, et cetera. So this, and as such, this story has been told and retold and retold. In the original story, the genie, there was two genies, not just one. And Aladdin had the genie of the ring, which was the weaker genie. And then the genie of the lamp he had acquired. But it was originally stolen by this big bad guy because he offered Aladdin's wife, I guess now Jasmine, she wasn't named Jasmine in the original story, said like new lamps for old. And she didn't know that the genie lamp, and he traded the lamp. He needed somebody to give it to him, and he went. It's an interesting story, but in it, like, there's no limitations on wishes. There was only limitations of power. You only have the lesser genie, and you need to outsmart the bigger genie.
Yeah.
But ultimately, it ends up being all about love, loyalty, and friendship. And that's really what every single story around this, even though a lot of the rules have changed, it all keeps coming back to this. Rags to riches, what's really important, it's not riches, it's love, friendship, and community. Yeah.
Love it.
Yeah. Such good
stories. One of my favorite Disney movies.
For sure. A whole new world. All right. That's not our announcement, but I do have a couple of announcements before we get to the questions that you should ask yourself if you decide to play with this trope in your novel. If you think this podcast is at least a dollar's worth of education and entertainment, consider supporting the show through our Patreon at patreon.com/mythosandinc. Something cool we've added to our Patreon rewards this season, bonus episodes of the podcast. So if you're a patron at the Kitsune or Kitsune level, what... Allie, do you know else?
It's Kitsune if you're American and Kitsune if you're British, according to Google.
Which do we go with? I mean,
I've always said Kitsune. I don't know.
Okay. And a good majority of our listeners are from the US. So maybe we should say Kitsune.
Although we welcome listeners from all areas of the world. FYI.
Poll of which pronunciation you would like us to use.
I've got it. Here's what I'll do. If you're a patron at the Kitsune A level or higher, you can ask us questions about world building, writing, or publishing, and we'll answer them in a patron exclusive audio. Become a patron now and get your questions in for November.
Yeah, send us your questions.
Ask us stuff. We're so smart.
On our writer's Discord channel, we often do flash fiction contests as an educational exercise. When we choose a winner, we work with the writer to edit and then produce them as audio works for this podcast. In June, our writing prompt was write a sci-fi or fantasy story in which the main character is dealing with either isolation or too many people. Our writer chose the latter, but as the story concluded, ended up with the former. Mythos and Ink presents Clockwork Flash by John Gunningham. Keen Brody had hardly accepted his first fluted glass of champagne at the annual Cogs and Bigton Top Hat and Goggle Gala before he was accosted by a military man, hair receding and green jacket sagging with medals. You there! You might be too young to remember the Battle of the 100 Whistles. Yes, I outmanned 100-1. Keen nodded, surveying the crowd with a thief's attention to detail. No necklace, ring, or bangle escaped his notice. The prize tonight, however, was no such bauble, but rather the gemstone-encrusted golden sprocket resting on its pillow of honor in the center of the hall. Maddie Horton caught Keen's eye. She, gorgeous, dressed in red. It was hard to miss. We were counting on that. Unfortunately, at that moment, she was being hauled from the room by two Bigton thugs. That wasn't part of the plan. Out of shot for the cannon, used skulls of fallen savages, hard-headed they were. Maddie shrugged, grimaced apologetically at Keen, then turned to talk to her captors, presumably asking what they were doing later. Keen ground his teeth while still managing a perfect smile. Lost many men that day, but those of us who survived became like brothers. Saul Martin made his entrance. He looked like he'd ransacked the closet of an opera singer, his bulk clothed in frills, ruffles, and red string tassels. He looked ghastly, but very proud of himself. Time for the backup plan. Look, old-timer, I've got to see an automatic man about a clockwork horse, you understand? Oh, yes, why, riding under command of General Jackson I, myself I had opportunity to— Great! Keen set off towards Martin like a suave eel in treacherous waters. He came at the other man sideways, speaking from the corner of his mouth.
Maddie's been nabbed. Martin, exasperated, speared a meat pie from the buffet. I'll need a different kind of distraction. Martin added 3 different pickle varieties to his plate. I am an artificer, not a jester. I do not perform. Listen, we've made it this far, right? Maddie's gone and flubbed it, but I've still got a chance. I just need you to thin the crowd. I suppose a little fire. Yes, good. Yes, just a little fire. I'll wait on you. Keen sidled forth. Bigton's treasure had his full attention now. It gleamed in golden glimpses between the milling throng. He felt the heat on his back and smiled as the crowd scattered, his prize now in plain view. Showtime.
Questions you should ask yourself if you decide to play with the trope artifact of power in your world. Emma, you're up first.
So I think you should ask yourself, what is the source of your artifact's power? Is it bestowed from the gods? Is it a piece of a magical animal? Or is it perhaps not even magical at all, but is it more of a meaningful symbol like Westeros' Iron Throne, which has an entirely different sort of power?
Is your artifact of power more than just a cool prop? Does it add something to the story?
Ooh. Or is it just a really cool sword?
Yeah.
Sometimes you just need a really cool, sword.
Yeah.
It's my sword of badassery, and that's all it is. My question is, what are the limitations of the artifact of power? Are they known or unknown to the user? Are they known or unknown to the reader? And how can that knowledge or lack of knowledge add to the tension of the conflict in your story?
We love tension.
Ooh, tension. No, we don't, Emma.
I see what you did there.
Stop world building our podcast.
So meta.
The hosts of the Wayfarer's Guide to World Building are staff at Mythos and Inc. Publishing, where we publish books for geeks by geeks. At the end of each podcast episode, we like to give a little insight into the world of book publishing by sharing what we've been up to. Emma, once again, you're up first.
I have been working with our Discord Flash Fiction authors. So you heard that wonderful Flash Fiction story from earlier. So I help to put that together. I run the Flash Fiction channel over on our Discord. So I've been coming up with prompts. I've been selecting our winners from each month. And then I've been going through the editing process with them for their stories. And it's a ton of fun. And I'm always in awe of the creativity and talent of all of our authors on the Discord. It makes me so happy.
It's really cool to see all the stories being posted.
Right? It's so hard to choose one. Oh my goodness.
I believe it. I'm glad I passed that off to you and I don't have to do that. I have been formatting Mythos and Inc's upcoming course, So You Want to Write a Novel? Now What? Which is an introduction to publishing, including how publishing houses work, what literary agents do, pitfalls to avoid, and information on contracts and licensing. It's jam-packed full of useful information. So be excited. It's coming soon.
And I had to record it all after Allie wrote it all. So I agree. It is exciting.
It was a group project.
It was a group for sure. My thing that I've been doing, I've been working on the tech side of things and building the academy, which is the place that's going to house the upcoming course. So it's like a whole place of learning. And more courses. It's a whole place of learning. Yay. Which we're really excited. And apparently I'm going to be working on some Flash Fiction recording. So I'm pretty excited about that too.
We if you're Kyle to record everything.
If you're looking for a sci-fi and fantasy writing community on Discord, go to mythosinc.com and join ours. If you have any questions, suggestions, or comments, email us at podcast@mythosinc.com or tweet us @mythosandinc. Until next time, fellow wayfarers, go build worlds.